you, Prime Minister, ministers, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. First thing's gone wrong, but what I'd like to do is to talk to you about some economic perspectives over three time horizons. Firstly, the last 4 or 5 years, to put a couple of things in context there. Then I want to stretch the data back 40 or 50 years to put a few other things in a bit of a longer run context. And then I want to, in the third part of the presentation, take a century-long perspective, talk about some large, longer run trends that are going on in the economy and that I think are of relevance to your work here today. So to begin with, let me just reprise a couple of things from my talk of last Friday, just to bring you up to date, and I'm sure you've heard about this last night, but this is a chart which indexes real GDP in Australia and a number of comparable countries over the last 7 years. So all the data here started 100 in 2005. You can see the effect of the GFC on us, that's that little dip there. This one up here is the Queensland floods taking out coal mining in the summer of 2011. And you can see pretty powerfully the effect of the crisis and the subsequent slow recovery on the other economies here, including some like Canada and New Zealand, which were not as badly affected by the financial crisis, say the US or the Euro area. In a way, this is slightly unfair as a comparison to some of the other countries because in countries like Europe or Japan, the population growth is low or negative. You really should do this in per capita terms to kind of make a fair comparison. And that's what this one does. And that actually does bring up the relative performance of Europe or Japan. Much argument though here about the curves at the top. So, It's a story that's been told many times, but it doesn't hurt to repeat that the crisis did affect us, and it continues to, but we came through that episode actually in pretty good shape in comparison to the other countries. Our economy in per capita terms is larger than it was at the previous peak, something yet to be achieved in those other cases. But we're all unhappy, right? There's a lot of disquiet and dissatisfaction out there in the community. We have a lot of talk about two-speed economies, patchwork economies. Not everybody feels it might be good, and so on. All of that's true. And there's no doubt that the mining boom, which is easily the biggest thing we've seen for 150 years, is geographically and industrially concentrated. But actually, the economy is always a patchwork. It's never a seamlessly woven garment. It's always something of a patchwork course. It's very rare that all sectors and all regions go at the same speed at the same time. Usually, if that's happening, it's a recession or an unsustainable boom. Most of the time, when things are normal, there are differences. I actually think that a lot of the disquiet and dissatisfaction that we see isn't really related to the mining boom at all. It's something that was going to happen whether or not the mining boom came along. And I think it's got a lot to do with changes in household behaviour, which come after a very unusual period of strong spending, leveraging up and saving nothing out of current income. And that was bound to end sooner or later. It has. In fact, it ended about 5 years ago. And we're still, I think, coming to grips with the importance of that now, and I think that is a significant factor that's behind some of the disquiet we see. Let me show you the pictures. This is a chart of real household income and spending, so it's adjusted for inflation. It's measured per person, and it's quarterly data back to 1960, which is the entire history of quarterly national accounts in Australia. It's a logarithmic scale, so you can take some information from the slope of the line as an indication of the rate of growth. Notice that in the 60s and early 70s, consumption and income grew at about 3% each. Saving rate was steady. Consumption grew in line with income. income, that's actually reasonably normal. There was then a long period where consumption growth was slower than it had been, but not as slow as income growth, and the gap between these two lines started to close. And then from 1995 to 2005, that kept happening. That was accompanied by financial innovation, gearing up, rising asset values, household saving went down. In fact, this measure of saving, which is the one published by the ABS, the net saving rate reached zero in the early to mid 2000s. Now, there's no science, really, I don't think, about what is the correct or normal saving rate, but I'd hazard a guess that zero probably isn't normal, probably isn't optimal, and probably isn't sustainable. That was always going to change. How could people do this? Why did they behave this way? Well, I think the answer's here. This is a measure of real household assets. There's a whole bunch of components in here, but the two big ones are your house and your ownership of the share market, either directly or through your super fund. The households of Australia own all the listed companies, apart from the share that the foreigners own. So the wealth components are shares and houses mainly. There's some other things, agricultural land and a few other things thrown in there, but they're the two big ones. And you can see that from 1995 to 2005, this grew in excess of 6% a year in real per-person terms. So by the end of that period, we had real per-person wealth on this measure of in excess of $250,000 per person. But it's very unusual for things to grow that quickly. If you look back to the 60s, that heyday, the golden era that we view through rose-tinted glasses of the good old days, wealth rose at a bit over 4%. It struggled then for 20 years or so from the mid-70s to the mid-90s, but then it's had a remarkably strong period up until 2005, actually about 2007 is the peak there. And then the trend has changed. So it's no surprise, really, that if households felt they were getting richer effortlessly, well, why save? You can consume close to all your income, and the future's being taken care of here. And the problem was that wasn't sustainable. Most of this wealth increase was coming about not really through physical investment and saving. It was coming about more through rising asset values, accompanied by rising leverage. Sooner or later, that's going to finish. I wasn't in the group of people that preached that this was immoral and going to end in a disaster, and I don't think it has ended in a disaster, but it was going to end, and it has ended, as you can see. So if the assumption was that we were going to keep on that path, there's a lot of disappointed people out there. And I think this is something that's quite important, and it lies behind a good deal, not all, but a good deal of the grumpiness, the dissatisfaction that we see among a lot of households. When you think about the sorts of businesses that benefited from that earlier period of strong spending and gearing up, it wasn't just retailers. Banks, with respect to our bankers, you know, if you open the doors, the balance sheet would grow 15% a year. That's a great environment, and they managed it quite well, but those days, I don't need to tell you, that has finished. So banking is different. If you think about all the parts of the economy that service turnover in housing, real estate agents, mortgage brokers, these kinds of businesses, well, the rate of turnover today is one-third less than it was on average in the past 10 years. It's 50% less.
That's a very big change. It's a very big change.
So you have And then we've got retailing, which struggles not only with a return to thrift by households, but the ubiquity of price information from the internet that shows the gap in price levels across countries, and I think that's becoming more powerful. So in short, we've returned to a rate of consumption growth after the dip there, which was in 2009. It's returned to growth, but not the old growth. The average rate of growth in this new period is about 1.5% a year, which, as it turns out, is very close to that average back there in the preceding couple of decades. So I think there's been a fundamental change in household behaviour here. I think it's understandable. I think it's actually wise. I don't think we're going to go back anytime soon to the preceding behaviour. And frankly, I don't think we should go back to that behaviour. I think we should regard higher rates of saving, around 10% here. I don't know if that's the right number, but it sure seems more likely to be sensible than zero was. And I think we, in the long run, this is a thing that strengthens our country because it strengthens the household's resilience through time. So that is, I think, an important thing that's behind some of, not all of, but some of the disparate performance we see in the economy. This was going to happen whether or not the mining boom came along. It's certainly true the mining boom is pulling resources out of other sectors via the high exchange rate and so on. But this was going to be happening anyway. And the truth is, I think, that had the mining boom not come along, we would be feeling the dampening effects of these things more than we are. Now, having said all that, I'd like to change gear now and go to a longer run perspective and talk about the future. This is a chart that shows shares of global GDP since 1900 for some obvious key regions, and you can tell straight away where the story's going here. The data are measured in purchasing power parity terms, so that recognises that some currencies are somewhat undervalued in the market, and it corrects for that. And that's the appropriate way to do these sort of longer run comparisons. Think first about the UK, which of course in 1900 was easily our dominant source of finance and our dominant trading partner. I think if we'd foreseen the next 100 years, that trend there for the UK would have been quite worried. The rising power, of course, was the United States, and you can see, if I can get the pointer to work, but I can't, well, you can see the Great Depression there, the dip in the 1920s. You can see the big spike as the Second World War. With that level of productivity, there probably wasn't ever much doubt about who was going to produce the most weapons and win. Since then, the US has been trend declining. The euro area's had a long-run trend decline. There was a pickup in the 50s and 60s that's, I think, basically the post-war reconstruction to rebuild all the destroyed infrastructure, but then they've continued that decline. China, of course, as we all know, if you're growing at 10% a year, you're doubling every 7 years, so pretty soon you're getting pretty substantial. On this measure, China is already as big as or larger than the euro area. In 10 years, it will be as big as the United States. And on these projections, we've used some IMF projections out to about 2018 and then put in some numbers for China that actually have much slower growth than we've seen in recent years, but still stronger than most others. And that's the result. India coming along behind there, not as quickly. Their population, of course, will end up larger than China's on present trends, but the rise in their per capita GDP is not going up as quickly, at least not so far. So this is a fundamental change. In a lifetime, indeed in a career, or even in part of a career of all of us here, the world is changing in a very fundamental way, in a way that it hasn't done certainly very often, if ever, before. That is occasioning, as you know, fundamental realignments in relative prices in the global economy. Roughly speaking, the prices of natural resources and energy are up, the prices of manufactures and some services relatively are down. Our terms of trade, Australia's terms of trade, are a rough proxy, pretty good rough proxy, for that relative price shift. Here they are. The history here is a lot of spikes, which usually have proven to be temporary. A long-run downward trend through the 20th century, and then in the past several years, even on a five-year moving average basis, way higher than anything we've got. This history's back to 1870, which is as far back as we have data we would even remotely trust. I suspect if we went back a bit further, we might, if we could measure it, we could get really big increases in the terms of trade, but this is the data we have.
So it's a big deal. How permanent will this be? We don't know. In the past, it hasn't been permanent. So really, it comes down to what's your view on the Chinese and Asian emergence? Is that a flash in the pan or is it going to keep happening? And what will happen, obviously, to relative supplies of natural resources and energy? And there's going to be a big supply response coming on. We assume, as shown here, I think, that the terms of trade, they have peaked and they are now falling. Our guess is they remain pretty high on average, but suppose that they fall a lot further than we've assumed. This is an adverse scenario that I've made up just for today. It's not a forecast, it's a what if. What if the terms of trade fell five times more than we presently forecast? Well, if they do that, that will take that five-year moving average back to the peak of the early 1950s. Now, most of us here won't remember that boom, but that was really quite a boom. It was all in the rural sector in those days, but that was a major boom that turned out to be quite disruptive for the economy, in fact, at the time. So unless you're very pessimistic about China and so on, it's likely that we have a relative price story that is persistently pretty different to what we've seen for the past 100 years. If that's true, then a lot of other changes follow. The exchange rate, and I know this is a topic for today, so I thought I'd give you a long-run history of the exchange rate, and this price is embodying an expectation about Australia's future, our terms of trade and other things about us. The lower of those lines, the orange one, is the exchange rate you read in the market every day. We think that a dollar is high, but actually I can remember it being $1.40 in my teenage. And if you go way back, in the days when we were pegged to sterling, we were way higher than $1. And there's been a long downward trend, at least until about 2000. The other line is the real exchange rate, and that what that does is that corrects for cumulative price level divergences between the US and Australia. And the message, the gap between the two lines basically is that over a number of devaluations through history in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we frittered away a lot of the competitiveness gain of a lower exchange rate through higher inflation. And therefore, the real exchange rate, which is probably a better gauge, well, definitely a better sense of our competitive position, that is actually pretty high here. Is it too high? Well, that actually depends a lot on what your view about the long-run future of the terms of trade, China, Asia, etc., what your view is. If all of that is a flash in the pan and is going to go away, the exchange rate isn't going to stay here. More generally, whether it turns out to be too high or not really is going to depend on us. It's going to depend on our capacity to adapt to changed circumstances. It's certainly true that areas that presently have high costs and low productivity and are trade exposed, they're struggling, there's no doubt about it. So the test really is how many of those enterprises can get the productivity up, because that's really the way out in terms of coping with a high exchange rate. Are we really going to compete with the low-wage centres of Asia with our wages? Well, we're not. And really, you know, there's no point pretending we can. What we have to do, it seems to me, is to try to compete with higher productivity. So it's a test of adaptability. One point I want to make before I leave the exchange rate is, while I'm very conscious that a number of sectors are really struggling with the exchange rate where it is, we shouldn't wish too quickly for a low exchange rate. Every time we put petrol in our car, every time we go to a store and buy consumer durables or clothing, a lot of which is imported, every time we travel overseas, we're benefiting from the high exchange rate. And indeed, as consumers, the exchange rate is one of the devices that is imparting to us the higher wealth that the mining boom brings. That's how all of us here are actually taking some of that higher wealth. I'd hazard a guess that all of us in this room fit into one of the three categories I mentioned, because we pretty much all have a car. We'd be buying imported things in the stores, and most of us here, I bet almost all of us have been fortunate enough to travel overseas at current exchange rates recently. So there are big benefits to us as consumers from a high currency, and that is part of the mechanism for spreading the gains of the resource boom. It is very tough for many businesses, but I think the question is one of adaptability. There will be structural change in the economy, and here is a long-run picture of shares of our GDP by industry. A couple of noteworthy trends here, to my mind. Firstly, I'm just too active with this pointer, so I'll give up. Manufacturing and mining have more or less traced out a mirror image over the past 100 years. Manufacturing's share of GDP has in fact been declining for my whole lifetime. It peaked in the 50s. It's been going down, not steadily, but certainly pretty consistently ever since, at many different exchange rates right through that period, I might add. Mining's share, of course, is going up, and it will rise further. The shares of those two industries today are about where they were 100 years ago. You can see the striking fall in agriculture from a third of the economy nearly to 3% of GDP today, the rise of government services, particularly through to the mid-70s, and then most prominent of all, I suppose, non-government private services that will be finance and a whole bunch of other things that are done of a service nature. And we are, like most developed economies, very much a service-focused economy. And I don't see that is going to change. So there's always been structural change occurring. It still is occurring. It's probably occurring right now at a somewhat accelerated pace, as happens from time to time. Yet, having said all that, it's happening at pretty high levels of employment. The unemployment rate around 5%, not as low as in the 50s and 60s, but actually not too bad at all compared to that long-run history. And when you look at ratios of employment to population, actually the economy's done a pretty good job, I think, overall, of employing those people who want to work. As a share of working age population in the 60s, 50% of the total population employed. Notice that that's actually a record high there, and that's because the share of working age population in total population has been at its peak in recent years, and that's now starting to go down, and indeed into the long-run future. The issue isn't going to be so much finding jobs for people as finding people for jobs, which is where the whole set of issues around ageing, retirement structures and so on comes in, and that's not my field, but I just point out that I think the economy's done a pretty respectable job over recent years of employing the vast bulk of those people who want to work. I want to finish, though, with, I think, the biggest challenge to us, and that's productivity. This is similarly a long-run chart of productivity levels dating from 1900. There are varying trend rates of growth, which are a little bit faint underneath the dark blue line, but I want to make a couple of points here. Firstly, this is GDP per head because we can't do per hour, we can't do multi-factor productivity over this long time horizon. So the point here is not to single out labour per se, because capital productivity is just as important, and it's really the combined effects of the labour and capital and their joint productivity in which we're most interested. But we can't do that data all the way back, so I've shown this one. I think it's pretty clear that for the first half of the century, productivity performance rather ordinary. The post-war period, all countries enjoyed strong productivity growth in that period. It slowed down in about 1973 for reasons that are still debated amongst economists 40 years later, as most things are still debated amongst economists more or less permanently. It is an area where fashions come back again and again. We had then a slowdown from 91 to 2005, actually pretty good performance here, and then there's no doubt there's been a slowing over the past 6 to 8 years. Now, you can cut these time periods slightly differently. If you did multi-factor productivity growth, the turning points for the trends are a bit different, but the extent of slowdown is more or less the same. It's quite material. It is true, as some people say, that there are some unusual things happening in mining that bear on this, but if you take mining out, you still get this story. So it's clear, I think, in the data that for some reason or other, or some set of reasons, there has been a material slowing in productivity growth in the past 6 or 8 years. There's a lot of debate as to why. Some people say that it's reform impetus is flagged. Some people say the low-hanging fruit was all picked in the 90s and that's done and it's now harder. Some people point out that this has occurred in other countries. That's also true, though probably not quite to the same extent. Some people with a lot of expertise in the field, say that sometimes these slowdowns happen and you can't really explain them and then things pick up again. All these things are at work. So I don't think it's sensible to be doctrinaire about why it happened. There are probably a bunch of reasons, and there might be some veracity to all of them. Nonetheless, the issue is how to get productivity to do better in the future. Why is that? Well, I'd nominate two reasons. Firstly, if you're struggling with a high exchange rate, to me, in those sectors, better productivity is the imperative to survive. And indeed, I think structural change that we're seeing is about high productivity. It's in fact a definition of getting to high productivity almost. And that is the challenge that's before us. And I think for businesses, it's about businesses and their workforces and their managements. That's where the productivity comes from. It's from those people every day doing 1,000 different things a bit better than yesterday. And for governments, it's mainly about making sure there are no impediments in the way to that process. So for adjusting to the challenges we face, it seems to me productivity is key. And then the second point that I'd offer is for governments, the resources that you want in order to do the things that you think the people have elected you to do, well, this is where it comes from. If there's not enough productivity growth, the resources available to governments via taxes won't be as much as you want. And your capacity to do the things that you feel you should do will therefore be reduced. So in the end, as usual, things come back to productivity. It's the challenge before us, and I think it was Paul Krugman said that in the long run, productivity is not quite everything, but it's almost everything. I think that's absolutely right. This is, now that the terms of trade have peaked, they've pushed up our living standards for the past 6 or 7 years. They've peaked now. Even if they don't collapse, they're not rising anymore. So the source of real income growth, actually, this is it. And that's the challenge that's before us. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm finished, and in the remaining time, happy to try to answer questions other than the one you all want to ask that you know I can't answer. Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is James Bourne. I'm not an international super spy. I am, in fact, a very boring economist. And I want to ask a very boring economics question. Last time I checked the data, up till December quarter last year, some of the sectors that were doing particularly well were sectors like legal services, financial services, professional services, and this is part of a longer run trend. I just want to ask Glenn, can you just give us an update on which particular subsectors in the economy are doing well under the current circumstances, and if those circumstances are going to continue, will these sectors do well? And are these, just to put a bit of a sting in the tail, are these sectors the ones that are receiving subsidies from the government?
James, I'm not able to give chapter and verse on what the latest by industry data said from memory. What I would say is that if you looked down the right-hand edge of the table on the value-added data by sector, you can certainly see the obvious candidates for strength there. I was struck by how many of the various service sectors and things that come under the label other, which is usually the strongest growing component in any economic statistics series. That's a rule. I was struck by how many of them had a 4 or 5 before the decimal point. So in that data, if we take it at face value, there were a number of sectors doing well, but I'm sorry I can't recount exactly all of them, but a number of them were those service sector areas. What is noteworthy in the employment data from memory, if you take that metric, over the past year, it's true that manufacturing jobs shrank, mining growth more than exceeded that, and the rate of growth of a category that's basically healthcare services, which would have a large public component, the rise in employment in that sector was about the same as the combined fall in manufacturing and retailing. So there's big shifts going on. Seems likely to me that some of those service sectors will probably grow pretty strongly into the future if you think about aged care needs and so on. So there's a set of issues for us there. But beyond that, I can't give you much on the detail, I'm sorry. Other questions? Don't be shy. They've all gone to sleep, Prime Minister, or so shattered or something, I don't know. But last chance, sir.
Ryan Stokes here, Governor. I guess just to pick up on the productivity point, because it's probably something that we're going to sense and feel across various industries, and just to to take that a step further, just to get some of your views on initiatives and steps that can be taken to drive that. Is that purely elements around kind of that adaptability, training, development, workforce flexibility, those are aspects that will enable us to be more productive, I guess, and ultimately how we face that kind of international competitiveness that's required with the shaping of our terms of trade, as well as the growing correlation of our economy onto China, I guess? Just wanted to kind of take that productivity point a step further.
Well, I'm often asked, what can we do to lift productivity? And I could give you, a sort of waffly sermon on the various things. But I think the best answer is we have a body called the Productivity Commission. Gary's here, I think, somewhere. They've got a long list of things to do. My answer to what we can do about productivity is go get the list and do them. They're not popular. They're very difficult and they're politically hard in many instances. But, these people are the experts. They spend their whole life thinking about productivity. And for my money, I don't think I could do any better than their list of things. I suppose I'd also add that some of the flexibility things that we need are in the arena of state-federal relationships, and I'm not involved in that, but from people that I know that are, it's very, very hard to do. But, they're the challenges before us collectively to try to make progress on those things. And each one, I've no doubt, is grinding work at, and very hard to achieve things, and none of them seem transformative in themselves, but the collection of them, if they can be done, will make a big difference. So that would be my answer on that, I think. Please. Just shout out.
Phil Bullitt from Skills Australia. You talked about productivity. I was wondering if you'd like to make some comments around participation. We know that the predictions are that participation is likely to decline with the aging population, but we we are performing lower than some of our other OECD countries in the area of participation. And I just wonder your comments about our capacity to change the trend down to move it up.
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to give detailed comments on how to raise labour force participation, only, as I said earlier, that it seems to me that we've been employing an increasing share of our population, and that has to have been a good thing. But I'm not really equipped, in all honesty, to make detailed comments on those things. I guess skills, effective marginal tax rates, all these things are very important, and they're very complex, and they're expensive to fix, quite probably.
And Paddy Crumlin, Maritime Union.
You left out capital productivity out of the overview because you said it didn't go back far enough. But what are your observations about the nexus between capital productivity and labour productivity, given that investment in infrastructure, technology inevitably has an impact on how work is done? What are the components and the breakdowns in that relationship?
Well, it's true that I couldn't put it on the long-run chart. If you look at, but you can do multi-factor productivity over the shorter periods, and the numbers, we'll be publishing something on this reasonably soon, but other people have also, the Productivity Commission's published stuff on this, and there's no doubt that if you measure MFP, it's also slowed down. So, and the extent of slowdown, depending on how you cut the turning points and the trends, is of the order of a percentage point or a percentage point and a half. So the collective productivity of the capital we have, and we've put quite a lot of capital stock in place, actually, in the past probably 15 years, the rate of growth of the country's capital stock has been considerably higher than it had been in the preceding generation or so. We don't seem as yet, anyway, to have gotten the combined, the sort of labour input, capital input productivity from that investment that you might hope we would. I can't give you, you know, a simple answer as to why not, but presumably that's going to go to a whole bunch of industry-specific, firm-specific things, practices and so on that you probably know a lot more about than I do. But the facts seem to be that even measuring multi-factor productivity in the market sector as best we can, there has been a slowdown, and you know, we can debate all the whys and wherefores, but I don't think there's much doubt that's occurred. Greg?
Governor Greg Evans, ALCI. Your graph in regard to GDP by country or region share. I mean, it seems to know pretty clearly our economic destiny between future WAG, India, and China. But looking back, say we were putting that graph together 25 years ago, would we have picked the same countries? And indeed, I think some of the conclusions of the Ghana report would be
indeed.
So I'm just wondering, at this point, are there any likely surprises?
Yeah.
USA and Europe versus Asia.
It's a good point. I mean, the future is not predictable. I think in 1980 we would have pointed to Japan. And, you know, there was that spate of books in the late 80s about how Japan was going to overtake the US and so on. Well, that hasn't happened. And Japan's share has been declining. And by the same token, I think if we'd known at the end of the bubble era how Japan was going to perform for the next 20 years, and they were then our largest trading partner, we'd have been very worried. And as it turns out, we've managed to adapt to the circumstances we found other trading partners, other things to do. So I suppose the moral from that is, the future isn't predictable. You can't set in concrete a strategy on the basis that we're certain China's going to do this and so on. We can't do that. I think all we can do is make our best guess, figure out what the implications of that are and maintain the adaptability and flexibility to either go with that scenario if it turns out or adapt to whatever else comes along. I mean, that's ultimately the secret, I think, is that adaptability. Prime Minister, I think we're due to have coffee and I don't want to hold people from it, so at that point I might quieten down. Thank you very much.